There's a scene in the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding where bride-to-be Tula recalls what it was like bringing Greek food to school every day.
I so badly wanted to be like the popular girls, all sitting together, talking, eating their Wonder Bread sandwiches.
What's that?
It's moussaka.
Moussaka?
The way Tula's food is different plays out as a kind of metaphor for the way she's different from her classmates without a strong ethnic identity. But if this story is common to a lot of kids whose cultural background is something other than undifferentiated white American, it's worth noting that it comes in 1,000 different flavors. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. While some kids are embarrassed enough by what's referred to as the lunchbox moment to run home and beg for Wonder Bread sandwiches, some are just outraged that anybody would dare to make fun of their favorite dishes, and still others find their peers curious to try the good things they bring from home. But those stories don't get told nearly as often. And my guest wonders if the food as a source of bullying and shame narrative might actually reinforce the idea that what immigrants eat is fair game, until it gets rediscovered by white urbanites who use their love of these foods as a marker of their own worldliness. Jaya Saxena is a staff writer at Eater, which published her recent essay, The Limits of the Lunchbox Moment. Jaya, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me, Chris.
So you first wrote about the lunchbox moment 5 years ago when you grappled with the fact that you grew up a half Indian, half white New Yorker who just so happened to love Pizza Hut. What was the conflict in that?
Yeah, you know, I think I was trying to recall as a child where I felt shame, because the story was a little bit about me being ashamed of various parts of my identity and various things that I liked that I thought I shouldn't like. You know, the main idea was I really loved Pizza Hut stuffed crust, mostly because I was 9 and it seemed really cool. And I thought, oh God, you know, I'm a New Yorker and I'm in this pizza capital. I shouldn't be liking this stuff. And all my feelings too about my Indian family, of how I felt a little guilty for the fact that there was a lot of Indian food that I didn't like. And I was trying to figure out, okay, why didn't I like it? Why did I feel the shame? And I thought, you know what? A lot of kids my age who have a parent who's an immigrant or are immigrants themselves had this experience where they were sort of bullied for their family's food by other kids, and usually mostly white kids. And so I wrote about that. And then I revisited this piece recently. And thinking through it a little harder, I sort of realized that I had never actually experienced that or even witnessed that. I could not recall a time in my life where I was ever made to feel shame by other people about my family's food. So it got me obviously questioning, why on earth did I write that if I didn't actually experience it? And I think it's because even if I don't remember experiencing it directly or witnessing it directly, this story of the lunchbox moment was so common that on some level, I assumed that it had happened to me. And I think it was so common that other people, both white people and other immigrants, assumed that I experienced it if I was a child of an immigrant myself.
So yeah, you've noticed that the lunchbox moment has become this kind of expected thing for kids with immigrant families. You know, given how many kids that equals in a country where 40 million residents currently were born in another country, it would seem like there would be 40 million variations on the story at the very least. But you found essentially one way this story gets told. What does that classic version emphasize?
Right. The classic version of the story emphasizes usually the first time, usually this moment where a child is made to realize that they are different, that they are considered an other, and usually in a negative way. I think the clip that you played from My Big Fat Greek Wedding really is sort of the stereotypical version of this story, where it's not like she thinks that moussaka is gross or weird, but she realizes that by eating it and by having it in her lunch, she's subjected to ridicule, and that it sets her apart from the people that she says, you know, are the popular girls, are the cool girls. And so Yeah, typically the story is something where a kid comes to school with a lunch that is not, as you said, I think, unspecified white food. And other kids go, ew, what is that? That smells gross. That looks weird. And they make fun of them for it. And this child goes home thinking, oh my God, my culture, my food, these things about me that I thought were neutral at the very least, are a cause for shame.
What is it about that version of the story that editors seem to like?
I think it's just such a straightforward story. You know, when it's told that way, and I want to be clear, that version of the story, I think the reason that it's become so popular is because it has happened to so many people. I don't want to discount that this is not just a fiction. This is something that has happened to thousands, if not millions, of people. But I think it's just when you whittled it down to that narrative, those couple lines of, I went to school with my food, the white kids saw it and thought it was gross, they made fun of me, I feel shame. You know, it's so clear. It's a really visceral story. You know, I think anybody can hear that and think, wow, I remember a time when I was bullied for something that was out of my control. You know, usually when you're a kid, you're not in control of what your parents put in your lunchbox. You know, so it allows people to remember a time that they may have been bullied for something that, right, they had no say over. And I think that it also makes it a story about individuals rather than structural racism and prejudice. If the issue is this one white kid saying your food is disgusting, and then later on, you either tell that kid off, or that kid apologizes or tells you, hey, I tried moussaka and I actually really like it. You know, it's all sort of wrapped up in a neat bow. And it's not a story that has to address things like living in a white supremacist society that are the things that are actually behind all of these smaller interactions.
Right, so the bad guy becomes the bully there. We're siding with the hero or the heroine who has been bullied, and therefore we can't possibly be part of the problem.
Exactly. Right. It turns it into, well, I like Chinese food, so I'm not racist, which is absolutely not how racism works. And I think we can very clearly see that there are, you know, I think now so many more opportunities for white people to eat food, for anybody to eat food from a culture that they don't directly belong to, for everyone to expand their palates. And that's great. That's wonderful. And you know, that should keep going. But just enjoying food from another culture does not automatically get rid of your prejudices against that culture.
Yeah, in fact, when these stories are recounted by adults, there's often like a coda about the white people around them having discovered the delights of these foods they once saw as unacceptably foreign. How often does that embrace include the white person taking a kind of ownership over not just enjoying these dishes, but cooking them and serving them?
Yeah, I think that, you know, a lot of that is just baked into the enthusiasm. I think anybody, if they try a dish that they've never tried before and find that they really love it, develop sort of an enthusiasm for cooking it or trying to find the best version of it or eating that cuisine. And I think that's really great. But I do think that there's, you know, there have been documented cases of all of a sudden white people being given the platform to say, hey, now I'm an expert in this cuisine. Hey, you know, this is mine now, or because I say it's cool now, it's cool. And you know, I know for a lot of immigrants and children of immigrants, there certainly is resentment sometimes over the fact that, you know, wait a minute, this is the food that I was growing up with, and this is the food that you all made fun of me for. Why all of a sudden is it cool now? You know, why wasn't it cool when I told you about it?
And of course, learning how to cook a particular recipe does not indicate that you have any particular special knowledge of the culture from which it emanates.
No, absolutely not. And I think, you know, on one hand, the great thing about cooking and the great thing about eating is that it is available to everybody, right? You know, if you can get the ingredients and if you can get the instructions to how to make a certain dish, or if you can go to a restaurant and try it made by someone else, you know, everybody has taste buds. You know, this is, you can experience something from another culture without having to get on a plane, without having to learn a new language, without, you know, all these other barriers to entry. So, on one hand, right, food is this really great way to start expanding your mind and learning things about different cultures and maybe starting to undo some previously held beliefs that you might have had. But right, it in no way makes you an expert about the entirety of a culture or what it is like to, you know, to be an immigrant, to be from that country or that culture or religion, just because you bought a cookbook of that food.
One person you interviewed had the sense that white people are somehow just drawn to stories of black and brown people's pain. What is that about? What did you understand that to mean?
You know, I think that there is this understanding that I think there are a lot of white people who do understand the way racism works, and that America, you know, has a long history of racism and white supremacy, and have understood that it is important to pay attention to Black and Brown people and immigrants when they tell their stories. And to believe them when they say, I've experienced racism, I've experienced prejudice, here are the ways that I've been discriminated against. And so I think it perhaps come, maybe I'm being too optimistic here, but it's coming out of that desire to say, hey, you know, I want to hear your story. I want to hear what happened to you, and I believe you. But at a certain point, it starts becoming expected that sort of pain is all there is and discrimination is all there is. And I think it's hard because as, you know, a child of an immigrant, I want to be honest about the places in which I've experienced discrimination or, you know, microaggressions or anything like that. But I also don't want that to turn into the entirety of my experience. You know, there's so much more to my life and my understanding of myself. You know, as an Indian person, as a child of an immigrant, than just, you know, the pain that I've had.
As you started asking around about people's experiences with the lunchbox moment, did almost everybody you asked have one for you?
There were a lot of people who had one, but there almost everybody that I asked about it said, okay, even though I experienced this, I'm really frustrated by the way this story plays out sort of on a larger scale. Because I think that, you know, in my piece, I've spoken to people who absolutely did not have a lunchbox moment. But even the people who did have one, it did not play out the way sort of that stereotypical story has been condensed. There were people who, yeah, maybe they were poked fun of by their food, but thought, hey, I love this food. Like, you kids are missing out.
So I guess, Jaya, you were talking about the fact that everybody has a story, but they are all different. If almost everybody has a story, does it start to feel like an essential experience for immigrant kids, like one that if you don't remember one, you must have simply forgotten it?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, there is this real desire by immigrant kids to want to share these stories and to want to sort of bond over them. I think that, you know, even if the lunchbox moment is a really traumatizing moment for a kid, when you're able to talk to other people who have experienced that and talk about how you felt, and how weird it was, and maybe, you know, how ridiculous the other kids were for not liking the food that you brought to school, it does turn into this real bonding moment. And so there's real power in sort of sharing these stories. But I think that, you know, as these stories get told over and over again, and maybe as they get whittled down and flatten down into the most stereotypical version of the lunchbox moment, it's something that becomes almost expected. And that if you haven't experienced it, or if you weren't traumatized by it, or if it happened in a way that does not fit sort of the very clean, flat narrative, you worry, you know, do I actually belong here? Have I experienced enough of what other people have experienced to sort of count within this community? I think it becomes, yeah, a real question and issue of belonging.
I was chatting with a colleague of mine who heard the promo for this show. His parents were born in the Philippines, and he remembered kids saying now and then, like, wait, you have rice for lunch? And he hasn't forgotten those moments, but he also remembers his dad saying basically, who cares if those kids think it's weird for you to eat rice? And he thought, you're right, who cares if it's weird for those kids to eat rice? But somehow that doesn't fit, right, with the idea that they're supposed to be, I guess, it's supposed to be traumatic in a way that, you know, for various reasons, people might have had support that made it not so traumatic.
Right. You know, maybe it did happen to you, but it was not the singular worst thing that's happened to you in your life. Or, you know, I spoke to a lot of people who said that, you know, even though their family came from other countries or they regularly ate, you know, non-white food at home, they never experienced a lunchbox moment because they were on the school lunch plan. You know, their family didn't send them to school with a pre-packed lunch. And so there's so many reasons why someone may not have experienced the story the way that it has sort of been codified over the past few years. And yeah, so I think that's just one more example. Even if a kid thinks, wow, that's weird to eat rice for lunch, you know, what does it matter?
What do you mean when you say white food or non-white food?
It's so hard to quantify, right? Because I think that, you know, over the years, what is considered one to be acceptable food in a school cafeteria has absolutely changed. I know it's changed since I was a kid. And I'm sure by the time I was a kid, it already changed since 10 years before that. You know, I think a lot of people, when the story of the lunchbox moment is told, it is a bit like in My Big Fat Greek Wedding, where these kids with these Wonder Bread sandwiches. It's kids with peanut butter and jellies or ham and cheese sandwiches. You know, maybe they have Lunchables with string cheese and little chopped up carrots and ranch dressing. You know, it's a lot of sandwiches, frankly. But I think, you know, it is, or, you know, maybe little microwave pizzas that you're served in the cafeteria, things like that. And so I certainly think it's not considered to be, you know, dumplings or fried rice or any type of curry or kati rolls. You know, foods that I think people consider directly tied to other countries and other cultures. But I think we also should recognize that's changing all the time, right? I think there are a lot of staples broadly of Mexican cuisine that are now completely acceptable in your average American school cafeteria. You know, pizza's been there forever. And there was a time in this country where pizza was considered a strange and exotic food. What we consider to be American food, what we consider to be white food, you know, it's really changing all the time.
I love the response you heard from one woman who remembered her classmates teasing her about her lunch. And she wasn't humiliated. She was angry. Like, how dare you make fun of this delicious food my family loves?
Yeah, no, it was such a great response because mostly just I cannot even remember being that confident in my own opinions when I was a child. But, you know, she's just like, you guys don't know what you're missing out on. Like, look at you over there with your cheese sandwiches on Wonder Bread. Why would you eat that when you could have this incredibly, you know, complexly spiced stewed okra? And I think, you know, that's a huge part of it, of the lunchbox moment, that even if you're made fun of, there's so many people who don't walk away feeling shame, but, you know, their pride is intact and they'll feel anger or they'll feel confusion. And they don't go home and say, oh my God, mom, you need to make me, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, or all the kids are going to make fun of me and I'll have no friends. They sort of double down on, yeah, I'm going to keep eating my own food because all of you are wrong.
So actually, this woman did ask her mom for more sandwiches, which ultimately her friends teased her about, but in a really different kind of loving way because they recognized that she was trying.
Yeah, no, I love those stories. All right, Kruthika, she went home. She was like, Mom, you gotta do something else. You gotta make me some sandwiches. And her mom was like, okay. But not being great at making sandwiches or super familiar with them, she would make sandwiches that I believe were essentially butter and marmalade, or sometimes butter and chutney. And, again, on the face, these just look like exactly what all the other kids are eating. But they know that something's different here. But yeah, it was an opportunity for the other kids to go, oh my God, why did she do that? What's up here? What sort of food do you normally make at home? And I remember her saying that, yeah, all of her friends would go over to her house and would love everything that her mom made and almost couldn't wait to see what was in her lunchbox every day because it wasn't the same as what every other kid was bringing. And they had an opportunity to learn about something new.
So even if these stories get compressed to a single narrative that turns out not to be accurate in a lot of cases, I would think they get shared by people who are hoping that, like, the moral is it's not cool to scorn anybody else's food. I've started wondering, though, is it possible the single narrative of the outcome also has the effect of, like, instructing white kids that they're expected to make fun of kids of color or kids who come from a different country because they bring something different?
That's really interesting. I don't necessarily think it serves as an instruction to white kids that you have to bully someone from their food. I do think sometimes it serves as instructive of telling kids of color and immigrant children that they have to feel shame. And I do sometimes, yeah, maybe think that it exacerbates these differences. That maybe if no one told you that this food was quote unquote different, it may not have occurred to you to even pay attention. I talked to some people for this piece who are saying that, yeah, mostly no one paid attention to what anyone else was eating because everyone was sort of eating different food. It was not as straightforward as 90 kids had ham sandwiches and one kid had curry. So I think that, most of the time, I don't know, is that really even what you're paying attention to when you're a kid? Is that something you have to pay attention to? And yeah, maybe kids would not if they hadn't gotten that message.
I have to say, I think it was in the 2016 essay that you shared this detail that your Indian grandparents who lived in the States when you were growing up, they knew you loved Pizza Hut, so they would take you to Pizza Hut. And it didn't occur to you until, I guess, adulthood that, like, maybe they didn't love Pizza Hut, that they were there for you.
Exactly. No, so it was something where so my dad was born in India and he and his parents moved here when he was really young. And my parents divorced when I was younger. So my dad, being my Indian parent, he didn't do a ton of cooking. He was really good at opening soup cans. And so the only time I ever really ate Indian food was at my grandparents' house. And because it was not a part of my daily life, sometimes I would bristle at it when I was younger. And I think they caught on to that and they wanted to find a way to relate to me and be able to have a meal together that I wouldn't, that I wouldn't be upset about and that I would actually eat. So they would say, hey, Jaya's here. It's time for a family trip to Pizza Hut. And, looking back on it, I feel bad that maybe I made them eat so much pizza when they would rather be eating something else. But I don't know, it felt really sweet in a way. It felt like they were really trying to meet me on my level. And then, thank goodness, eventually I realized exactly what I was missing, with the food that they cooked.
Do you think they gave you a little bit of a pass because you were half white? Like they maybe imagined that somehow you couldn't fully embrace this, I mean, kind of delicious food, but like you were still a kid.
Oh, certainly. I mean, I think that, being half white was certainly part of it, but also I was born and raised in America. And I think that, you know, they moved to America in 1962. There were not that many other Indians around. So they very much got the message like, okay, we're going to need to eat American food. We're going to need to learn how to cook with American ingredients and sort of assimilate into this culture because we don't have any other choice. And I think that, yeah, they never blamed me because they knew I was born and raised here. So of course my tastes were going to be different than theirs.
Do you have a sense for why people picking on the food that you love feels so personal in a way that maybe if they make fun of your parents, whatever car they might have or the color of your house or whatever, doesn't feel personal in quite the same way?
Yeah. I think that, again, there's something so visceral about food. Because when you eat something that you think is delicious, you know, that's an emotional experience on some level. You know, when you've been craving something for weeks, you know, I think now if you live outside of your parents' home and you go home and they make you this thing that they've been making you since you were 5 years old and no one can make it like your parents make it, you know, it's just such... it's an experience that's tied up in so many emotions, so much nostalgia, that's bigger. It's bigger than just liking something or disliking something. And so I think if someone makes fun of that or says that it's gross, it's so much easier to get defensive because it's almost like they're attacking your emotions and your tastes and these things that make you who you are. If they make fun of your parents' car, you can be like, well, I can't drive, or I would have chosen a different car, or, you know, it's not, I just don't think choices like that are as deeply, deeply tied to culture and identity the way that food often is.
Yeah. And of course, the food is made for us by someone who loves us. So there's a direct line, right, between making fun of the dish and somehow making fun of the person.
Exactly. Like if someone's making fun of, you know, what your mom sent in your lunchbox, you know, on some level, it feels like they're making fun of your mom. And that feels like a bridge too far. I think there's just a real emotional component there, that it's not just your lunch they're making fun of. It's you, it's your family, it's everybody who looks like you, it's everybody who has, you know, immigrated from the country that your family immigrated from. It feels just so much bigger.
Does it frustrate you, Jaya, that surely some of the same people who harassed their classmates in childhood for bringing things that they viewed to be unacceptably foreign or whatever are the ones who brag to their friends now that they found this awesome Ethiopian place across town that they want to take you to? Does it bother you that people grow up and like forget that they treated their classmates' food in these ways and treated their classmates in these ways?
I mean, it certainly doesn't bother me that a child would realize that maybe they were wrong when they were a child and grew up to be a more thoughtful and open-minded person. Like, I hope that's everybody's trajectory, right? That we're not holding on to the same ideas that we had in childhood, or if we had a harmful idea, we learned and grew and did better. You know, I think the question there sometimes is, right, have they tried to make amends for it? You know, if they're still in touch with that kid, did they acknowledge what they did? Did they apologize? And that's not always available to everybody. You know, I don't think I'm in touch with nearly anybody that I went to elementary school with. but I think that I would hope that anybody who had that trajectory, you know, sort of at least acknowledge that to themselves, admitted when they engaged in racist behavior and thought, and said, okay, now I'm going to make the active choice to not do that anymore. Whether it's by trying new things, whether it's by, trying to shed themselves of prejudices that they were taught to hold. Yeah, it's not necessarily the trajectory that's frustrating. I think it just needs to come with some of that acknowledgement and work.
I don't know if you have kids or not, but have you thought about the things you would want to make sure to share with your kids that you ate as a child?
I don't have kids, but I do think that I have a niece and nephew, and even though they are by marriage and are in no way Indian, there's part of me that's like, I want to be able to make some stuff for them. I want to
Yeah.
be able to make puri for them. I want to be able to give them the Indian cookies that I had growing up. These are just things that I loved, and I think they would love too.
Jaya Saxena is a staff writer at Eater, which published her recent essay, The Limits of the Lunchbox Moment. Jaya, this has been really interesting. Thanks for making time to talk with us.
Thank you for having me.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Ana Perez, Nilufer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Madison Hurd, Sriya Reddy, and Rolando Hernandez. You can listen to Think wherever you get your podcasts. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.